This is a podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. It is the highest, driest, coldest and windiest place on Earth. We're not talking about Mount Everest, we're talking about Antarctica, a vast white expanse that few people have ever been to. The only people there are scientists trying to unlock the secrets of this mysterious place. It's relatively close to Australia and we do claim 42% of it, however most countries don't support our claim. But that's what we're going to be talking about this morning and overnight. We're going to talk about Antarctica, especially attempts to depict it in books and films. I was trying to think of a movie set in Antarctica where that was the backdrop to a murder mystery or a romance, and I simply couldn't think of any. But there must be some. There's the occasional TV show, and of course there are stories about the people who try to explore Antarctica. But what do we know about it beyond just that? This morning, our guest is someone who has visited Antarctica four times and has written about it extensively, including in her book Antarctica in Fiction. Ellie Lean is a professor of English at the University of Tasmania and is our very special guest this morning. Professor, good morning.
Good morning, Rod.
Firstly, what drew you to Antarctica? What was the thing about it that made you want to kind of explore it in your own way?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I'd like to say that I had this passion for it since I was a young child, but that's not really true at all. I gave almost no thought to it for the first part of my life. But what happened was I did an initial degree in physics and then, to my parents' consternation, turned around and did a degree in literary studies. And then in my PhD thesis, which I did in the UK, I tried to combine those two fairly disparate interests. And I did a PhD looking at science communication in the language of popular science. And then I landed a job at the University of Tasmania here in Hobart. And I was really looking to change my direction of research in a way that, you know, kept that science literature angle, but really spoke to the place where I was here in Tasmania. And I landed upon the idea of Antarctica, the so-called continent for science. And doing a bit of research, I realised that almost nobody in the humanities had ever really thought about Antarctica. So the field was wide open and I started from there and never really looked back.
So give us an example of some of the key films or books that do depict Antarctica, perhaps from a fiction point of view rather than non-fiction or a non-scientific point of view.
Yeah, I mean, just to answer the two questions that you posed at the beginning, There is a romance set in Antarctica, came out quite recently, a film called Till the End of the World, which was a Chinese film. There was a murder mystery called Whiteout that came out about 10 years ago. So those things do exist. But the sort of more prominent texts in which Antarctica features, a lot of them are fairly early, so sort of 19th century texts. But the most famous early one would be The Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. That's from the late 18th century, quite a famous poem. In English, but then you've got a couple of books by Edgar Allan Poe, also in a fairly gothic mode, like Coleridge's poem. Jules Verne wrote a novel set in Antarctica. Joseph Conrad wrote a short story there. Australians are probably really familiar with Douglas Stewart's
The Fire and the Snow.
Yeah.
But that's based on a real life story, isn't it?
Yeah, it's based on Scott's expedition, and after the what you call the heroic era in Antarctic exploration, which is sort of late 19th, early 20th century, you do get a lot of literary responses to those famous expedition stories. So there's a couple, for example, by Thomas Keneally that people will know. And then there are sort of really big sort of genre fiction blockbuster type texts. So Matthew Riley's Ice Station is one that a lot of Australians remember. Jim Stanley Robinson's book Antarctica, people who read science fiction might be familiar with that. There was a book about 10 years ago called Where'd You Go, Bernadette, which was a massive bestseller in which Antarctica featured strongly.
And there was a movie with Cate Blanchett. They made a movie.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. So a lot of the movies actually are based on books. So while, you know, film's not my speciality, you know, I do look at film because often, you know, those films come from the books that I study. Mm-hmm. And the really, the film that people know is The Thing. I don't know if you've seen that
the
one.
The Thing.
The Thing, classic horror film from 1982 by John Carpenter, pretty well-known horror director, with really quite gruesome special effects. But, you know, if anyone's seen, there's a recent thriller called The Head, which is similar in a way to The Thing. So, you know, and Antarctica features, for example, in the TV series Atypical that people might have seen as the obsession of the protagonist of that TV series. So, you know, it does come up over and over again. There's a lot more fiction and literature about Antarctica than people ever imagine.
Yes,
you know, when I began working on it, people thought it would take me about 2 weeks to read all the... And so did I, really. I thought, oh, gosh, this will be a quick project. And then when I got into it, I realised there are literally hundreds of novels set in Antarctica. And there's quite a few poems and plays and a handful of films as well. So it's really been quite a big research topic, and then I've sort of broadened out to other things as well.
Well, just while you've been talking, I thought of another one, Biggles Breaks the Silence.
Classic.
You're a fan of Biggles Breaks the Silence?
Yeah, I'm not a fan of Biggles generally.
Oh, come on. What's the matter with Biggles?
Yeah, sorry about that. But, yeah, Biggles Breaks the Silence. And from memory, that one is about, you know, it's about gold that they find in Antarctica. So, you know, around that time, sort of mid-century, you get books that are interested in the kind of resources that might be available, and then you begin to get this series of thrillers. Another one that people might know of a certain generation is The White South by Hammett Innes. That sold millions of copies in the late 1940s, and that was a murder mystery set on a factory whaling station in Antarctica, and that became a film too with Alan Ladd called Hell Below Zero. So when you dig into it, there's an awful lot there, and it sort of matches the different periods of Antarctica's own history, the way that writers respond to it. So it's a really interesting way to think about how humans have imagined and responded to Antarctica over the years.
John Hurt and Hayley Mills in the movie Mr. Forbush and the Penguins, says Joan in Armadale.
That's a really good point. By Joan, and that's another one that was based on a book by a New Zealander called Graham Billing. And what's really interesting about that movie is that they actually took John Hurt down to Antarctica with a crew, and he lived in the Antarctic Peninsula. I think the Argentinians enabled that one. And, you know, he lived close to this enormous penguin colony for a number of weeks. And that's really unusual in feature films, because it's incredibly expensive to film something in Antarctica. So you get a lot of documentaries, and often that just involves, you know, a camera person, a sound person, a small crew. But to take a whole film crew down, you know, the amount of people involved in films when you see the scrolling at the end of a film, or the makeup, costumes, sets, etc. To do that in Antarctica under those conditions is nearly impossible. So almost all films set in Antarctica are filmed elsewhere, often in Canada. But that's a really unusual one, because it's actually filmed in Antarctica, as was the Chinese one that I mentioned earlier. So there are a few that are, but mostly it's either a stand-in location or increasingly it's using computer graphics to do it.
Of course, Happy Feet and March of the Penguins were two Oscar-winning films. One was a documentary, one was an animated children's film. So I suppose they also had... part of Antarctica, or the Antarctica was a huge part of that.
Yeah, I mean, March of the Penguins was a really big hit back sort of, was about 15 years ago, and certainly that was filmed on location. And Happy Feet, that was an animated film, but interestingly, they took a lot of footage from Antarctica to make that film and incorporated that into the CGI. Mm. So in a way, Happy Feet, even though it's a children's film about dancing, singing penguins, is a bit more realistic than some of the other films set in Antarctica that actually aren't filmed there, at least in terms of the environment. Yeah.
What about in New Zealand? Have they ever made a movie about the Mount Erebus disaster?
I'm not aware of a movie. I do know that there is excellent poetry written about the Erebus disaster. The poet Bill Manhai has written some really touching poetry about that incident. I think it's a little bit raw, actually,
Yes,
for there to be a film
it's
about. I
not
mean, it's
too soon.
similar to the Scott tragedy, although obviously on a much greater scale, Erebus. That, you know, with when Scott's party died, nobody wrote about that or tried to do any kind of response for, you know, at least 20 years. And Kathleen Scott, Scott's widow, opposed any kind of
Right.
production. I think just it was too raw. And I think that's the case with the Erebus disaster as well.
So with Robert Falcon Scott, who did get to the pole, I think, but he arrived second after Amundsen, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And so was forever seen as a failure for some reason, I'm not quite sure. It has given us one of the great lines in literature or in real life. You tell me whether it actually happened when Captain Oates, when they were running out of food, he knew that he would have to sacrifice himself so that perhaps Scott could make it home safely, which sadly he didn't, where he says, I'm just going outside, I may be some time. Did he actually say that? Where did that line come from?
Yeah, that comes from Scott's diary. So that's the only proof that we have. That Oates said that. If you look at Oates's other writing, it is really in keeping
right.
With the understated kind of way that he spoke. So he may well have said something to that effect. But also at that time, you know, Scott's writing in his diary, they were getting pretty desperate, and Scott knew that they probably weren't going to make it back, but he had an idea that maybe the diary would make it back.
Right.
So he's certainly writing for the public at this point. And one of the things about Scott is, for all his other failings, and we could argue about those, he was a great writer, you know, and so he crafted his diary really effectively. So it may be that he nuanced Oates's statement to sound, you know, the way it does. It's a fantastic line, isn't it?
It is a brilliant line.
Might be Oates and then embellished by Scott, because Scott really had a way with words. And I suppose even though, you know, he does have a bad press at the moment, I have a real soft spot for him because he was a literary sort of person. He loved words.
It is, you know, even allowing for the freezing cold, it's the most stiff upper lipper statement ever said by an English explorer, isn't it? I'm just going outside, I may be some time. I mean, that's a remarkable feat of self-sacrifice.
Yeah, it is. I mean, people argue about, again, you know, he had been holding them up for a long time by this stage. So in a sense, Oates had already sentenced them to death by the time this happened. He could have walked out early. I mean, I'm not criticising him for not doing that. I certainly wouldn't have. But yeah. But in a sense, it's you know, it was a bit late for him to have done that. But it is a fabulous line from him.
Airship 9 by Thomas H. Block, says Michael, partly about nuclear devastation and set at least partly in Antarctica. Thanks very much for that, Michael. Mark is with us. Good morning, Mark.
G'day there. How are you going?
Very well, Mark. You want to talk about the $100 note?
Well, yes, I grew up in the 1980s when the introduction of a $100 bill came into circulation in Australia, and at that time, it on one side of it was Sir Douglas Mawson. And I guess for me, the interesting element was it then, I think from memory, I think I did it perhaps, I mean, I've always had a self-interest in history and so forth. But in essence, then the fact that he was seen as a prominent explorer of the time, now, I can't remember which exposition he was with as such, but and then there was a couple of, they were sort of like docos that sort of went along with a storyline, I think in the 90s with Shackleton and so forth.
Yeah. Okay.
And then there was, I think something ABC's done in the last 10 odd years or something was, or I think it was on actually the show that does those antique things, where there was a tin that had been sent back to either the British Museum or something. But okay. In terms of stories, I think getting back to Mawson was the element that he was seen as a prominent Australian explorer when Antarctica was being opened up there in the early 20th century.
Indeed. All right, Mark. Thanks, mate. I appreciate that. Ellie Lean, Professor Ellie Lean from the University of Tasmania, is with us. So Shackleton and Mawson are incredible stories. The Shackleton story is just remarkable. Have there been fictionalised versions of that or even a decent film made about it? I mean, there have been various documentaries also about Mawson's expeditions. What do we know about the way those stories are told?
Yeah, they are told and retold. There was a television miniseries about Shackleton that came out a while back, starring Kenneth Branagh, I believe, as Shackleton, and Frank Hurley, the Australian photographer who was part of that endurance expedition, also played a big part in that one. There've been, you know, biopics. There's a biopic of Scott of the Antarctic that came out. I think that was about 1948. That a lot of school children are aware of. So there are definitely, you know, recreations of all of those classic expeditions. I'm not aware of a fictionalization of Shackleton's expedition, but there are certainly you know, cultural responses to all of them. And Mawson, of course, is the standout Australian hero. And to answer Mark's question, I think in the balaclava that he wears on that.
Oh, the most famous balaclava of all time, isn't
it? Yeah, I know. And people, you know, there's a knitting pattern that you can get, and it's fantastic. But that was from the Banzari expedition, that particular image, which was when he was a bit older. It was in sort of the late 1920s, early 1930s. But the one he's famous for is the Australasian Antarctic expedition, which happened back in 1911, the same time that Scott was exploring. Of course, Scott asked Mawson to be part of his expedition.
Thank goodness he did.
And to be on the polar party indeed. And if Mawson had said yes to that, well, that would have been a very different story. I think, well, maybe they would have got back. I mean, Mawson was incredible, the endurance that he had. But Mawson said no to that because he wanted to lead the scientific program, and Scott already had someone to do that. So. Right. Mawson led his own scientific expedition, and I could talk more about that expedition. I've done a little bit of work on that.
Okay, well, there's a few things we need to talk to you about. One of our texters says, have any books been written about Rod Marks, the first murder victim in Antarctica? There was a rumour he was the victim of a potential serial killer who had second thoughts after watching his gruesome death. What do you know about that?
Well, Rodney Marks was an astronomer at the South Pole who died of, I think it was something like some kind of alcohol poisoning or some kind of poisoning. And it was all a little bit mysterious, and it sort of went to the difficult legalities when, you know, crimes happen in Antarctica of who does what. And I think there was an autopsy done back in, he died in the South Pole, which is a US station, but it's right in the middle of the continent. You travel to it via New Zealand. The Americans go down via New Zealand. So New Zealand did an autopsy, and it was a little bit inconclusive. I mean, if it was a serial killer, yeah, I mean, it's almost too good a plot, really, in that there is a novel that is about a serial killer at the South Pole. I very much doubt that was the case, but it is one of the unsolved, you know, mysteries.
But it may not have been murder. He might have just died.
Yeah, I think the autopsy concluded that it wasn't murder, but I think there's still, you know, question marks over exactly how he came to imbibe whatever substance it was that he took.
So your first journey to Antarctica was as part of a writer's residency. You travelled there on an icebreaker, which is an incredible adventure in itself. What was it like there? And, you know, how do they feel about outsiders? You're not a scientist coming in there, even though, of course, you have a doctorate. You know, how do they treat outsiders? Are they happy that there's someone new coming in, or are they kind of suspicious of outsiders?
Yeah, there is a dynamic that psychologists have studied where, you know, people who've been wintering, you know, they've been together for a long time as a small group. They do feel a bit, you know, threatened, I suppose, or concerned about the influx of visitors that they get in the summer. I mean, that's not just artists and writers, but everybody that turns up after they've been, you know, isolated for so long. I arrived in February, so that's at the end of summer, and, you know, people have been coming and going in summer, so that's not so much of an issue. But I have to say I was a little concerned about being this writer surrounded by scientists. You do feel a little bit out of place, and you wonder if what you do, you know, is considered serious enough. But I was in a small group of artists. So I also had, there was a visual artist, a painter that came along. There was a science communicator, Tim Lowe, that people might have heard of. There was an environmental historian with me. So we were kind of a little posse of artists and writers, and look, we were accepted so well. And I think The voyage leader really facilitated us seeing things and doing things. Because if you're not careful, I mean, I was on a what's called a resupply trip. So you go down to the station, and Casey Station, in my case, the ship resupplies the station and then comes back, and it came back via Macquarie Island. And if you're not careful, if you're not sort of prominent enough in the voyage leader's mind, you might just stay on the ship. But he made sure that we all got off, that we all got interesting things to see. You know, on Macquarie Island, I got to go for a hike and stay overnight at one of the little huts. So I really felt like we were treated well. I think the Australian Antarctic Division takes its artists and writers pretty seriously and makes sure that we actually have an experience of the continent. Other artists stay the whole summer. Occasionally someone winters. It's less usual. But I think those programs are really important for making sure that, another side of Antarctica is brought out, and a side that people can relate to that aren't necessarily so interested in the science but are more interested, you know, in the artistic side of responding to the continent.
So you went back again, this time to Ross Island, where McMurdo Station is. How different was that when you were there for a bit longer?
Yeah, I mean, that was different in a number of ways. And this is something that I try to emphasise in my work, that Antarctica is not just this one place. I mean, it's a huge continent, and your experience is really going to depend on where you go. So Casey Station, where I went on my first trip, is an Australian station. It's fairly small. It's pretty isolated on the coast of East Antarctica. And I got down there by icebreaker. But on my second trip, which was with a bunch of students, it was a course at the University of Canterbury run, which has field work in Antarctica, pretty amazing experience. You fly down and the New Zealand program piggybacks on the American program. So you fly down in a US military aircraft from Christchurch in New Zealand. And those aircraft don't have windows, so you don't see anything as you fly down. And suddenly you get out and it lands on the ice, and you're just hit by this blinding, white ice plane. So it's a really abrupt transition, as opposed to the icebreaker where you go through slowly and you encounter Antarctica bit by bit. And then Scott Base, where we stayed, the New Zealand base, it's not dissimilar in a way to Casey, but right next door to it is McMurdo Station, which is the big American base. And that can take up to about 1,000 people in summer. So you can imagine it's more like a little town than a base, in a sense. So, you know, it's got a church. I went to a service in the church. It's got, pubs. It's got cafes. You know, you can walk around it like you would a town. You know, you walk and people are jogging past you. There's all sorts of people living their lives in that base. So, you know, a really different experience. And also a lot further south, so it was colder. On that particular journey, we spent some time in the field, literally in a field in Antarctica, but out on the ice camping. And, of course, that's a really different experience to being on a station. It's a lot colder, for one thing, but you feel, much more immersed in the environment. And we had Mount Erebus, as a backdrop behind us, and you can hear the ice beneath you as you're lying there trying to sleep.
Wow.
Hard to sleep because it's light the whole time.
Mm.
So, it was a really different experience for me. And, it gave more depth to my knowledge of Antarctica. And I think every time I go back, I feel like I add something new. I thought I knew the place, but then I find out something different. Of course, my trips have only been to the coast. I have never been to the interior, and that would add a different dimension again.
Graham in Hornsby, and this is, I think, a famous story. He says, I read recently about Mawson's party, and maybe two of them would have made it back if they had declined to eat the dog livers. Now, this was a really sad story, that they had dogs pulling the sleds and they had to eat the dogs later on, but because they ran out of food. It's a terrible story. But because the thing was, it was all about whatever vitamin is in liver, and they thought they would be getting it by eating the dog livers, but in fact that made things worse, didn't it?
Yes, not this. It's slightly different to that. So it's vitamin A, which is the
vitamin A, yep.
Difficult thing in dog livers. So what happened on that expedition back in about 1913, Mawson and two other men set out to do this big trek. And tragically, one of the men plunged down a deep crevasse and was never seen again, a really horrifying incident.
Yeah.
And with him went most of the food and a bit of the equipment and a bunch of the dogs. Mawson and his companion, Xavier Mertz, who was a Swiss ski champion, had to get back on these low rations. So they began eating the dogs, which is actually not that unusual, you know, on an Antarctic expedition. But Mertz's waterproof trousers had gone down the crevasse, so he was already in trouble. And then they think, I mean, it's really hard to know, but eating the dog livers might have had an effect because of the vitamin A, but it also might have been in Mertz's case that he was, you know, he was wet from not having the trousers, he was exhausted, he was hungry, and eventually he succumbed as well. And then Mawson had to make this fairly epic journey back to the hut on his own. I forget how far it was, but it was an awfully long way. And he only just made it. He was very depleted when he got back to camp. So that's one of the great stories to come out of that expedition. And in a sense, it's a kind of story of failure. You know, the expedition didn't get to where it was going. Two men died horribly, and Mawson made it back. But it is a survival story, unlike Scott's, where everyone died.
One of the things about Antarctica these days, of course, is tourism. Now, boats go down there. Sometimes people get off and are actually on it. People are, you know, concerned about planes flying down there and landing and taking tourists there. Other planes just fly over it and then come back. You've been there as a tourist as well. What was that experience, and what's your general feeling about tourism to Antarctica? Because, of course, it's such a delicate environment, you couldn't possibly disturb that environment.
Yeah, I mean, we are disturbing that environment on a really wholesale, in a really wholesale way, by what we're doing here back in, you know, in lower latitudes. I mean, it's all the emissions that we're putting out that's actually most impacting Antarctica and melting its ice. So people do get quite concerned about tourism, but I think really it's a minor point compared to what else we're doing to the planet. I mean, I wanted to go on a tourism voyage because I became interested in Antarctic travel writing and Antarctic travel culture generally. And most tourism goes through South America, the tip of South America, a little city called Ushuaia, which is a really interesting place. And then you go down across the Drake Passage, which is pretty rough, but Antarctica, the Antarctic Peninsula there is a lot closer to South America than the Australian part of Antarctica is to Australia, so it's just a couple of days. And then you're in this incredible environment. And again, emphasising, you know, the differences between different parts of Antarctica. So the peninsula is sort of more like an alpine environment in a sense. It's got that really mountainous beauty. It really is incredibly spectacular. Whereas the Australian part, at least that I went to, and also down at the Ross Sea, is a much kind of starker beauty, like a desert, much more monumental, minimalist kind of beauty. But so the Antarctic Peninsula was quite different, and also the wildlife encounters that you get there are incredible. So I saw an enormous number of humpback whales, which I hadn't seen. I hadn't seen any whales on my previous trip. But what's interesting to me too is the way in which that tourism experience gets curated, because of course as a tourist you can't just go anywhere. In Antarctica, your experience is very subscribed, and there are a lot of rules put around it about what you can do to minimise that disturbance. So landings are really carefully managed. You'll be in a roped-off area, or you'll be on a Zodiac with a guide. So your experience is always being guided and presented by people. And one of the things I've become interested in is how that sort of presentation of the experience works, you know, what sort of lectures people are given, what information they're given about the place, and what impact that has on them going back, and what kind of relationship they then have with the continent when they return. You know, are they inspired to protect it, or do they just tick it off as another place they've been to? So, yeah, I mean, I understand the concerns about tourism. I mean, the season before COVID hit, there were 75,000 tourists who went to Antarctica, a lot of them by cruise ships, some of them by what's called air cruise combination. So you fly into the South Shetland Islands, you get on your cruise ship, you go on your cruise and you fly back, so you don't have to deal with the Drake Passage, that sort of rough sea voyage. So there are a lot of tourists, but they're in a very small part of Antarctica mostly. I mean, there are some that visit East Antarctica and other parts, and there are some that ski to the South Pole and some that climb mountains and some
ski
that
ski to the South Pole.
Yeah, you can certainly go to the South Pole as a tourist. I mean,
how far is it from the coast where they land?
Oh, it depends which coast you go on. It depends whether you leave from the edge of the sea ice or the edge of the continent.
And
But
I'm guessing that there's nothing to see once you get there. I mean, yes,
Oh,
you.
well, there's a big station.
Yeah, that's right. As you say, there's an American base there, but really there's nothing to see as such. I mean, it's just white the whole way, I'm guessing.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's less homogenous than you might think. I mean, people who have lived there talk about, really, really becoming attuned to the nuance of the place. It's not completely flat. There's sastrugi, which are the kind of hummocks of ice that you get because of the wind. There's the occasional nunatak, which is a sort of mountain poking out of the ice. But I mean, this is speaking from someone who's not been there, but it is a pretty, it's like a desert, but white. And when I was at Scott Base camping on the ice and looking towards the pole, it really is just a complete plain of ice. So no, not a huge amount of variation. And I think that experience is really just the kind of the sense of getting to the end of the world. It's a bit of a strange idea in a way, isn't it?
Well, no, because I mean, it's one of those places that if you say to someone that you've been there, you can pretty much guarantee they haven't. And that's what, travelers' tales are all about, aren't they? Is trying to
Yeah, I mean,
one
it
up
is a boast,
somebody.
but
Yeah.
yeah, I think I'd like to think that we could get away from that sense of, it being all about me and my heroic accomplishments and be more about, understanding the place and getting to know it and wanting to take an interest in its future.
Rick from Wodonga says, I remember in secondary school geography having the IGY, the International Geophysical Year, as the theme in studying the Antarctic. That was, I think, 1959. Donald Fagen wrote that song about it. And Jenny says there was a man named Graham Thorley. Are you familiar with him,
No, I
Ellie?
don't know Graham Thorley. Who's that?
He was commissioned to go to Antarctica to paint the scenery. He was in a dilemma as he had no idea what paints to take, as no one had painted much down there before. This was in the 1970s, and his paintings were beautiful, says Jenny.
Yeah, I mean, p people had been painting there for a long time. I mean, back to, say, Cook in his expedition in the 1770s. I mean, a lot of the expeditions took artists, Edward Wilson. On Scott's expedition was one of them, but they did indeed struggle with the conditions and not having their paints freeze and all that sort of thing. So I imagine that was also the case with Graham Thorley. But a lot of visual artists have travelled to Antarctica over the years and have had to deal with the extreme conditions in what they do.
Bruce also mentions the must have been a children's book, I think. Ivan Southall was a children's author. He wrote Simon Black in the Antarctic in 1956.
Yeah, and there have been a bunch of children's fiction set in Antarctica. It goes right back to the first one I found was from 1870, which was called At the South Pole by a really big children's writer at the time called W.H.G. Kingston. And that has it has a polar bear on the cover.
Oh, great.
And there's walrus attacks and there's shipwrecks and there's volcanoes and you name it, they're in there. So there is this long tradition of sort of boys' own fiction set there, and still now you often get children's novels set in Antarctica. Some of them very good. Yeah.
Let's talk to Anne. Good morning, Anne.
Oh, good morning, Rob. Look, about 5 years ago, I took my two adult children and they're on a small expedition ship. There was only about 100 of us, and I learned so much. It changed my view of the world. Such a magic place, and we learnt a lot from the people, the lecturers on board about it. And we were very blessed with wonderful weather, even in the Drake Passage, which wasn't very rough at all. And we got out quite a bit on the dinghies. There's to be a total eclipse. I think it's the 4th of December this year in Antarctica, and it won't happen again then till 2039. I had hope that I might be able to go to see it, but anyway,
Don't
nobody's
think that'll
going
happen
anywhere.
now, no.
No, but it was, look, it really was the most beautiful, unique place that one could ever go to. It really was wonderful.
And I'm glad that you had such a wonderful time, and thank you so much also for letting us know about the eclipse. What about that, Ellie? What do you think about an eclipse in Antarctica in December?
I think I want to be there and see it too.
Mm.
Wouldn't that be incredible?
Spectacular. What about COVID in Antarctica? Have there been any cases?
Yes. So, you know, for most of last year, you got this, you know, the news reports were all around the last continent with no COVID. And then just before Christmas, there were some cases at a Chilean station, a couple of Chilean stations on the peninsula. You know, and that's where people fly in, fly out quite frequently, that part of Antarctica. So it's not all that surprising. I think, a military ship, you know, passed it on during a resupply. But it didn't spread. You know, the rest of the continent is still COVID-free. But it's a real, you know, it's really quite challenging, I think, for the national programs because everybody now has to go into quarantine, you know, before they go south. So, and, you know, people are coming in through the Antarctic gateways like Hobart, having to quarantine here and then go down to Antarctica. They're very stringent about it. So I think it's probably likely to stay COVID-free. And, of course, the tourism industry has really been pretty much decimated by it for the last couple of seasons.
Because if it did have a major outbreak there, there's really not a lot that anyone can do. I wonder whether now in future you're going to have to be vaccinated before you go there. We've heard incredible stories about the woman who had to perform surgery on herself. If there's no doctor there, then you're really in trouble in Antarctica, aren't you?
Yeah, that was Jerry Nielsen at the South Pole who discovered that, you know, what she suspected was breast cancer. And she was wintering at the South Pole. It's really very difficult to, you know, to get out of there. That it's impossible, essentially. So she had to do a biopsy on herself. And there was a classic one back earlier. I can't remember exactly when, but there was a Russian station where the doctor had to take out his own appendix using a mirror.
Unbelievable.
So, you know, these days, you know, increasingly we have the capability to get planes and supplies in and out of the continent, even occasionally in winter, but not in those interior places like the South Pole, you know. So, yeah, I mean, it is a real risk. You would not want something like COVID ripping through an Antarctic station. You'd be in a lot of trouble, so they have to be extraordinarily careful.
Tell me what you think we can learn from Antarctica through fiction rather than non-fiction writing about it. What greater truths are there when someone writes a novel about it rather than writing a non-fiction book?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And people sometimes ask me why I don't look at the non-fiction, because in a way that's probably much more read, you know, than the fiction is. And I actually do look at the non-fiction as well. But I think literature is interesting because it doesn't have to stick to the facts. Because people can speculate, they can imagine how things could be done differently. So you get novels like Kim Stanley Robinson's novel Antarctica, where he thinks about Antarctica in the future and thinks about the threats to it, thinks about how humanity might react to those. You get a whole series of utopian novels which imagine how things might be done differently in a place like Antarctica. So, you know, because it doesn't stick to how things are, it opens up possibilities to how things might be. I tend to think of literature as how humanity dreams about Antarctica. You know, both its nightmares. So you get lots of novels which are, you know, gothic horrors or murder mysteries and so forth, but also, you know, its positive dreams about, you know, what it might mean for humanity's future.
It's a bit of a shame, isn't it? Because more people should go there in order to experience it, but the more people that go there, it ruins the experience.
Yeah, it is a bit of an irony, and it is something that you have to balance up when you think about something like tourism, that you want people to be able to experience this place and come back as advocates for it, but you really, you know, have to put a lid on that so that it doesn't become overwhelming and destroy the place that we're trying to protect. And I guess one thing to focus on is how we can get better experiences for people to encounter Antarctica who don't visit. So, you know, things like VR experiences are becoming more common to try and immerse people in that, you know, Antarctic world without having to actually visit it. And places like Hobart, the gateway city, is an ideal place to do that.
So if we can't get there and most people will never have that pleasure, Is there a novel that you think comes closest to capturing the beauty and just the whole environment there in Antarctica?
I'm going to have trouble putting my finger on just one there, Rod, because there's so many and they all give, you know, a really different sense of the experience. I guess I'd probably suggest people start with The Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Samuel Taylor Coleridge, because that's the earliest piece of Antarctic literature in English and maybe the most influential. And although only the first part of it's set in Antarctica, you know, it's got some really beautiful imagery. But it's hard to just point to one. I've got my own favourites, but you really need to read a few, I think, to get that prismatic idea of Antarctica as a complex place. It's not just one place, so any novel's only going to give you a one-dimensional view of it.
Sure. What about Biggles Breaks the Silence? Surely.
That oh, yes, of course. There's that one, of course. I would always point people towards that.
Our final caller this morning is Josh. Good morning, Josh.
Oh, good morning, Rod.
Your brother was there.
Yes, he was on the last run. He went down with Inari with the army to man the Larks, and they were the amphibious resupply vessels. So they were wheeled as well as obviously boats, and they were getting they got to Macquarie Island and pulled up in one of the bays there, Buckle Bay may have been, I think. And they'd got most of the supplies off, most of the people and stuff off that were had to be dumped there. And his mate was, they were having their first beer in the bar, and he's looking out the window and he said, "Hey, do you want to see something funny?" And Tim says, "What's going on?" And he said, "Well, the ship's just dragging its anchor and it's just smashed into the shore," so they had to, all hands out to get anything else that had to come off, and then they had to drag the ship, drag it out further out and scuttle. Well, they were about to scuttle it, and it caught fire and sank anyway.
Oh dear! What an extraordinary adventure, Josh. Thanks very much for that. Sorry, we're running out of time, so we're going to have to go. But thank you, Josh. That's a remarkable as well, isn't it, Ellie?
Yeah, and I mean, there are these incredible experiences. It's interesting to hear how many of your listeners, you know, have been to Antarctica or know someone who's been there. And I think it is part of our culture, and there are some incredible experiences that we need to capture, don't we, through oral histories or similar things. There's all these stories that make up our understanding of Antarctica. We need to get them down, I think.
Yes, I think certainly the expeditions there should be doing that. Professor Ellie Lean, thank you so much for telling us in such vivid detail about your visits to Antarctica.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure, right?
Professor Ellie Lean from the University of Tasmania.
Overnights with Rod Quinn on ABC Radio.